And so the supersymmetry is going to be right. It has to be spontaneously broken so that the ground state has to be non-invariant. And then particles that are related by supersymmetry need not be exactly the same mass. And being the same mass is important. The thing I never got to last time was so if you, you saw that, that supersymmetry relates couplings and masses of bosons to fermions. And the reason, why was that a good thing? What are we trying to do? We're trying to exclude the, we're trying to prevent getting terms like phi star phi. A correction potential which goes like phi star phi with a big mass squared in front of it would be a bad thing. And the kind of Feynman graph that would give you a correction like that would be, you know, a scalar field, say, and it would have a self-interaction. So you could draw a graph like that, maybe, or you could draw a graph like that. Here you have a phi to the fourth interaction, and here you have a phi cubed interaction. Those kind of interactions are, if you had a fermion going around a loop, you could do that. What is the tau coupling? And here on the outside is a phi. And there's two of them, that's kind of why there's a phi star phi. Those kind of graphs, if you evaluate them, tend to give you contributions like this, where m would be the typical mass for what's going around the loop, and you get coupling constants, so you get things like coupling constant squared, and then because there's a loop, you get 1 over 4 pi quantity squared, and so on. And what happens in supersymmetry is that all these graphs, because if your potential, supposing your potential had been the one that we had, if w was 1 half m phi squared plus 1 third g phi cubed, say, so w prime is m phi plus g phi squared, g factorial, so I think 1 half. W prime prime would be, in that case, m plus g phi. In that case, you know, the Yukawa coupling is basically this. So this says that the Yukawa coupling is going to be given by g, because this is the term that's, this is what multiplies the two fermions, and then there's the scalar field, so that's the Yukawa coupling. But the potential was w prime absolute value squared, so that the coefficient, say, of phi star phi squared in that case is basically 1/4 g squared. And the cubic thing will be the cross term between this and this. So there'll be things involving g m times phi star phi squared and other things like that. And some numerical coefficient here. But what you've done is you've related the coefficients. This cubic term is now goes like g squared m squared, right? And this coefficient here goes like g squared, because it's a quarter coefficient. This goes like g squared because it's got one Yukawa coupling h and each Yukawa coupling g. And then the mass that goes in this answer is set by dimensional analysis. It's coming from the propagators and integrating over all the momenta. In dimensional regularization, the only thing in the problem that has dimensions is the mass. So once you calculate this coefficient, you're going to get whatever missing powers of m you would have had, you'll get. So this one will get a factor of m squared from that and that and that. And so it happens that the fermions have an opposite sign. And with the numerical factors that go in here, supersymmetry is arranging, it ensures that this plus this plus this equals zero. And that's what's making these things stay small. Supersymmetry, what's happening is that supersymmetry is relating mass terms to scalars. Mass terms for scalars are getting related to mass terms for fermions, because this, for instance, this mass term here, you know, the thing that's appearing in the fermionic piece is m. The thing that appears in the scalar potential as phi star phi is this squared, so the masses are related to one another. And so what's going on is if you turn this mass, you make m zero, then this problem has a bigger symmetry than it used to have. And so all the corrections to m have to be proportional to the things that break that symmetry, and that turns out to be m in this theory. So the corrections to m turn out to be logarithmic in m rather than being proportional to logarithmic in the cutoff or in the large mass scales. And so the corrections to little m end up being proportional to little m. And so if you start off with m being near the weak scale, you don't get things that are, I said that in a bad way. The corrections to I'm mixing two stories that's happening. Here we're not worried about NC truth press, you want gauging areas, it's just a story with masses. And so the story here is that what actually happens is that in the quantum corrections, that you can show that the quantum corrections to W, there are no quantum corrections to W. All the corrections to W are in the field theory or in the kinetic term. So this cancellation is actually really good. And so that you don't get the order m squared corrections to the quadratic term in the potential. And so that's useful. So if you now try to apply this to physics above the weak scale, the idea will be that we're going to pair off with every known particle somebody with the opposite statistics. And a cancellation like that will work. But it won't be exact, because we know that at the end of the day, we're going to have to spontaneously break the supersymmetry. We're going to have to make the masses different. That cancellation required the masses in every one of those loops to be the same. And it required the couplings to be exactly the same. And that's something which is not going to be any more true when you spontaneously break supersymmetry. So what typically happens is that if the difference between the bosons and the fermions, if that mass difference, if you call that delta m supersymmetry, that's the supersymmetry breaking scale, then the failure of this cancellation tends to be of order this. So the delta v in that case turns out to be something like delta m supersymmetry squared by star phi. Because they're not exactly canceling, but the failure to cancel is coming about because the masses are split by a certain amount. And if the masses had been, it has to vanish as the splitting goes to zero. And so typically what you find is an answer like that. And so if you replace standard model by the supersymmetric standard model, where all the superpartners have larger masses, large enough that they haven't been seen, so they're split by the particles we do see by things at least several hundred GV or TV in scale, then you'd be completely protected from integrating particles that were very, very high energy, because those things are only split by, again, this much. And so the dependence on the large mass is canceling, and for very large masses, because for very, very, very heavy particles, a splitting of this size, if this is of the order of TeV or so, that's much less than if you have particles whose mass is the Planck scale or something, not quite very, very large, but much bigger than this scale. This kind of splitting is very small, so the cancellation is actually working very, very well. And so the corrections to the Higgs mass here, are being canceled. The large part of the contributions are being canceled out, and it's the failure to cancel for all the multiplets is of this size. So the picture is, you can get away with it as long as you don't split things by more than about this size, and so that you can't have the superpartners also up at the 10 to the 10 GV or higher. Somebody has to be quite light, because the rationale for the symmetry in the first place was to understand why this term is not large. And we know the observed particles are very light, so that if this splitting is of the order of what we think is reasonable for this coefficient of the Higgs term, it has to be true that the things that we're not seeing aren't so far away from being seen. So that's the rationale. But the whole rationale relies on these things not being too heavy. So what would you need? So how do you supersymmetrize standard model? Well, basically, the simple thing is to take a copy of everything you've got. So what do we have already? We had, so we take spin 0. Let me do this on the next board there. We have spin 0, 1/2, and 1. In the standard model, we had at the spin 0 level, we had just a Higgs doublet. in a half level, we had electron doublet, we had the right-handed electron, we had the left-handed quarks, the right-handed quarks, right-handed down quarks. And then in spin one level, we had all the gauge fields, right? We had the U1, the SU2, and the SU3 gauge fields. So now what we have to do is you might ask for some economy, and that how do these things transform? Under SU3 cross SU2 cross U1, and remember the doublet was a singlet, a doublet and it had hypercharge plus a half. The lepton here was singlet, doublet, and minus a half. The right-handed singlet was a singlet. This is the left-handed anti-electron, so it was a charge plus one. And the down quark, or the up quark, I guess the quark doublet was a triplet, a doublet. Then we had to get the charge two-thirds in the numerator, so we had one-half plus one-sixth, two-thirds. And for the up quark, we had anti-quark, a singlet, and it was a minus two-thirds. And the down quark, we had an anti-quark, plus two-thirds. Now, all these symmetries commute with supersymmetry. So that means that whatever the new thing is that is the superpartner of all the particles we know about, it has to have the same transformation laws under SU2 cross SU3 cross U1. So because these are also different, that means that whatever the new things are, there are things that we haven't seen before. The only possible exception could be that we could take H complex conjugate, for which this would be minus a half, and then you might economize by making the Higgs superpartner be the lepton doublet. That's a little bit tricky because when the Higgs gets a BEV, it's going to break any symmetry it carries, and that would mean that you're in particular, since this carries lepton number, you're going to necessarily spontaneously break lepton number. And so that can run into trouble because you're going to have a Goldstone boson for lepton number breaking, so that will mean there's a light scalar field in the problem. And so those kind of models tend to run into trouble very easily. So the economical thing is you just copy one copy of everything. So this has a copy which is different from this. So that would mean that the partner for this would be, you know, what we call a Higgsino. Partner for all these guys will be spin zero things. So we have a partner for a lepton is called a slepton. But the nomenclature is the partner of a boson that's now a fermion ends in eno. And the partner of a fermion, which is now a boson, starts with an S standing for scalar. So you have sleptons and squarks. So these are all complex scalars. And they transform under the standard model this way. They just put twiddles on everybody, and that's what they do. So some of the exercises you had in your homework talked about squarks, which were basically these things. These things were the complex conjugates. They were the partners of the quarks that were required for supersymmetry. And their existence complicates what you can do, because you can certainly write different interactions down now than you could have before. These guys all get partners that are called gauginos. So there's a there's the Bino, the Wino, and the Duino. The partner of the positron is this positron. And then the Higgs, what do we have left? That's everybody. So that's the minimal version, you would have thought. And there's one thing missing, actually. So now what we have to do is ask, what are the supersymmetric interactions? Well, so what are we looking for there? We're supposed to write down, there's gauge interactions, which you can write down for free because you know the gauge quantum numbers, right? You know how they, if you know how they transform, you know how they couple to the spin one particle. So the coupling of these guys is fixed. The kinetic terms will have covariant derivatives in them, and you just read them off from the transformation rules. The things that we want to write down in detail are the scalar potential, and we want to write down the, because there's a lot more scalars, we want to write down the Yukawa couplings. Those are the things that are not specified by gauge invariants. And that's, for those, I need to tell you what the superpotential is, right? This W has to be some sort of a cubic, holomorphic, Holomorphic just means it's a function of these fields here and not their complex conjugates. But it also has to be SU3 cross SU2 cross D1 here.
To
be more normalizable. So when you remember that the something quadratic gave me something which was a mass, and something which is cubic gave me a top coupling, and because you're getting terms in the Lagrangian like psi bar gamma left psi times dw d phi squared, that kind of thing is happening. So to be more normalizable, this has to be linear in phi. So that means that the w has to be most cubic in phi. But if you want to break down non-normalized interactions like we did, then what you would do is you'd relax this cubic step. You'd allow a larger polynomial. So, so what can you do? So you write down, so W, the trick is you can't write down complex conjugates. That makes things more complicated. And for the Higgs, for the standard model Lagrangian, we were typically taking Higgs's and Higgs's complex conjugates all the time. But we can't do that. We have to write down just supersymmetry requires us to have H and not H star. So if you kind of look at what we can combine, it's going to be the same kinds of things as we had for the top couplings. So if we had a, I guess the first thing we can do is we can write down L with an E as a, it's a singlet, it's a doublet, and it's got hypercharge plus a half. So that we cannot make a combination with that, but that means that we can always do it if we have an up type thing. So we have this with this. 1/6 minus 2/3 is going to be minus a half. So this with this with this we can make a singlet from, right? So we have something like y up q u h, and you're contracting the indices in the way that's invariant. And then remember, we have one of these for every generation, so I should keep a generation index. And so you should think of this as being, this is like a Yukawa coupling matrix. I have y, ij. If I keep the generation indices, that's what I've written. I've not written any gauge indices, but they can get contracted with me in the way they have to make.
Shouldn't H be transform under SU2 as 2 bar?
Yeah. 2 and 2 bar are the same thing.
Okay.
There might be a matrix involved. You can make a singlet of 2/2s because a two bar is a similarity transformation for 2. So you can make a singlet of that. So the way to make a singlet is you take the anti-symmetric tensor. That would be a singlet. The thing I'm using is that if you take the complex conjugate of the Pauli matrix, that's the same thing as M sigma A M inverse, where M is I sigma 2, I think. Either that or sigma 2, maybe it's sigma 2. Possibly not, I can't remember, but there's a matrix. So, and it's probably gets minus that, it's probably the condition. So, that's one thing to write down. What we can't write down is things, you might have thought, why not do the same thing in the standard model? We had a Q, a D, a Higgs term. But remember, that involved Q, a D, and a Higgs complex conjugate because the hypercharge had to be the opposite sign. That's also why we can't write down L and E in Higgs terms, because it also requires a complex conjugate. So the problem is that as we've done things, we haven't got a Higgs. You could have said, well, it was up to us whether we called the Higgs or the Higgs complex conjugate. So we could have started off with the one that was the complex conjugate. And then when we got to this point, we would be able to write this down for a down quark. And then we'd be able to write this for, we could do the same thing then for an electron type thing. We couldn't do it for down to the up-type quark. So you can only do it for one or the other. So if we want to get a mass for everybody, you know, these are ultimately going to be the atomic couplings, because we do two derivatives with respect to the quarks, and we're going to be left with a Higgs, which is going to be a VEB, and we're going to stick that into a term like this, where we've got two quarks here, because those are the things. If I had an index here, I and j, this would be d phi I, d phi j. So if I differentiate with respect to the quark fields, I'm looking at two quarks in the fermionic action, and I'm evaluating at the Higgs doublet, the scalar, and that's the Yukawa coupling. So we need these terms, and we need it for both the up and down type things. So what you're forced into here is to, the simplest thing to do is to have two Higgses. So distinguish between this I'd call the down type Higgs. And then what I had before would be the up type Higgs, 1, 2, plus 1. So now we can do this with the down type Higgs. And with the up type Higgs, we can write down. But we're not allowed to couple the up Higgs. Supersymmetry and gauge invariance forbid couplings that go the wrong way around. The up type Higgs to the down type quarks or leptons, vice versa. But if we do that, you know, this guy transformed the same way that guy does. So anything that has an L, I can replace it with an H for free. So in particular, I can take this one and I can write it as a. I can write down something like, I'm going to call this now Y, let's call it now Z. I. Well, before I do that, let me write another term. So I can also write bilinear terms, right? Because this times this is the variant, and this times this is the variant. So I can have things like mu, H up, H down. And I can have things like mu twiddle, H down L. And I can have anything here involving an H down. I can make that an H down for free. I can make that an L for free. So I've got Y E I J twiddle I J K, I guess I'm going to say L I E J L K. Z I H D D I H D. Can you think of anything else I could write? There's probably a quark one I could write, but I think one of those and two of those. Can that work? Yeah, that can work. So I can make three triplets I can make into a singlet, because that's like a proton, right? Three quarks can make a singlet. And then I can take two of these, one of those, and make a singlet, make them cancel. So I can get a UDD. I can have XIJK, UI, DJ, DK. What else can we have? Oh, it was a Q L D term if you're in. Yeah, I could have taken this one and made that an L. Yeah, I got that one. Good. Okay, I think that's it. So those are the only things we have. And some of these things we like. So that's great. That's going to give us the Yukawa coupling we want. That's going to give us the Yukawa coupling we want. That gives us the Yukawa coupling we want. That's going to give us something like the, you know, we wanted a term which was quadratic and Higgs, like phi star Higgs dagger Higgs with a mass in front of it. And so far, the only thing here, if you don't include these things yet, that has any dimensions to its coupling constant is this one. So this will be like a Higgs dagger Higgs term. That's a good thing. But all these ones suck, because they all break lepton number or variant number. So this one has got breaks. This breaks lepton number unless H carries lepton number. But if H carries lepton number, then these interactions are going to start breaking lepton number because lepton number went out. So this breaks lepton number, this breaks lepton number, this breaks lepton number, and this breaks barium number because it's got three quarks in it. And that breaks both. So one of the nice things about the standard model was that you wrote down the most general thing that was consistent with all the symmetries, the gauge symmetries of the problem, and you automatically found that what you got preserved barium number and lepton number for free. You didn't have to ask for that. And that's observed to be true in nature. And here, that's not true. Here, at the renormalizable level, you can write down things that are breaking barium number, lepton number. And that's because you've got, if you thought in terms of the Lagrangian you're writing down, you can write down new power couplings that are involving these new scalar fields you didn't have before, which carry lepton number and barium number, because those partners are things that do. And the existence of those new fields is allowing you to write down interactions that would violate at the renormalizable level things like barium number and lepton number. So the fact that you don't see protons decaying is telling you that you can't have all these terms there. So this is one way in which supersymmetry is less appealing than the standard model, that you have to actually, it's harder to understand why barium number and lepton number would be conserved.
But the transform over some terms.
What's that?
Transform over some terms.
Like which ones?
In the standard model, we do some transformation between the...
Redefinitions is the simplified things. Well, you can always, what we'll do is once you make the, replace these by their vevs, then you can always diagonalize the mass terms like we did before. So you can always, I've already made that, I'm assuming the kinetic terms are diagonal and have the standard form, and then the mass terms we can always diagonalize, but we won't want to do that until after we replace the things by the vev and shifted from the vacuum expectation value. And once you've done that, then the only freedom left were the ones which were symmetries. And if we kept all those things, there are no other symmetries, so that means that there's no more freedom to redefine at that point. But if people really do those, they think of reasons to not have these things. So one way to go is you can just say, well, so barium and lepton number are conserved. They're global symmetries. We don't know why they're conserved, but they're conserved. And then just forbid yourself from writing these things down. What people normally do instead is they say, because people are uncomfortable with that because of the fact that the standard model was so successful on giving it. And we've seen neutrino masses, so we know that all lepton numbers aren't exactly conserved. So we can't conserve all the lepton numbers. We should only be trying to conserve some of them, but only by the ones that are broken are only going by small amounts because the neutrino masses are so small. So what people think of is, what are symmetries that can forbid these kind of things from appearing? And a simple example of a symmetry would be is what's called arm parity. So it's a simple symmetry. Which keeps the ones you like and kills the ones you don't like. Killing all B violating and L violating interactions in a qubit W. And that is to say, so R parity is just defined to be -1 to a power, and the rule will be everybody we've seen is positive, everyone we haven't seen is negative. R to the x, where x is equal to 0 for all standard model particles, and x is equal to -1, or since 1 or -1, so minus the parities in all superpartners. So that means that, in particular, these things are the things that I'm talking about in the superpotential. Remember, are always the scalar fields because we differentiate them, evaluate them as functions of the scalar fields, and those are the Yukawa couplings of the scalar potentials. So we can read off what the quantum numbers are for the scalar fields from what they really were for the particles involved. So this is supposed to be R. So the R parity of this one is plus because that's the particle we know about. This one's a minus. These ones are all plus, because we know about them. So these are all minus. And these ones are all plus, so these are all minus. So what counts for this thing is the R parity of the scalars. So that means that the Higgs is plus and everyone else is minus. So that's going to give us minus minus plus, so this whole thing is plus. This is a minus minus plus, that's again plus. Minus minus plus. This is now plus plus. But here we've got the plus minus, so that's why that's ruled out. Then here we've got a minus minus minus, so that's ruled out. Here we've got a plus minus plus, so that's ruled out. Here we've got a minus minus minus, so that's ruled out. Minus minus minus, so that's ruled out. So it exactly kills the ones you want to kill and not the ones you don't want to kill. And there's a reason for that, because another way to think of what X is that X is a linear combination of Darian number, Lepton number, and Fermion number. So it's going to be three Darian numbers. So let's just see what that would be. So for quarks, we want it to be minus, so this is going to be zero, this will be plus. So, actually, no. So for the sports, for that's zero, we want it to be plus, that's good. So for the fermions, we want this, let's say minus, could be plus, doesn't make a difference because it's only mod 2. And for the leptons, we want this to be, yeah. So if you take this combination for X, you'll see that it, mod 2, it's 0 or 1, the way I told you. So if you take the Higgs, it's got B and L is equal to 0 and Fermion number 0, so that means it's plus. For all these guys, the leptons carry lepton number, but no baryon number, but and they all have Fermion number 0 because they're all scalars, so that means the leptons here are going to be minuses. The sporks here are all going to be, they all carry baryon number 3rd, so 3 baryon numbers is going to be 1, and the lepton number 0 and Fermion number 0. And then the Fermion number is there because it just ensures that when you go to the superpartner, Fermion number changes by 1 and nothing else changes. So that means that whatever this is the opposite. And if you do the same thing down here, it also works. So the fact that this is conserved is, you know, we were looking to make these things be conserved. And so it's not kind of a complete accident that there was a discrete symmetry which could make preserve. If we're only restricting ourselves to cubic polynomials, we could get away with the discrete symmetry and get the conservation of these things. If we went to quartic polynomials, we can write things down that are invariant under that, but still violate Baryon number and Lepton number. And those are actually ones you'd worry about because those are only dimension 5 interactions, so they're suppressed by 1 power of 1 over mass. And you'll see that the constraints on proton decay actually work very well if you had them arise at dimension 6, where the rates are suppressed by 1 over m squared. The amplitudes are suppressed by 1 over m squared, so the rates are like 1 over m to the fourth. So they're dangerous, the things that are quartic, but they're not terrible. If you actually take a specific theory, supersymmetric theory, that can generate these interactions, the dimensionless coefficients are small enough that you can get away with it. So this existence of this parity is really it's motivated by the necessity to kill these terms, but it has an important effect. So this implies that so regardless of the details, the existence of a symmetry like this implies that the lightest particle we haven't seen is stable, because it carries a charge that no one that we've seen carries. And if it's the lightest one carrying a charge, it has to be stable because there's nothing it can decay into which carries that charge because it's the lightest one. So the lightest supersymmetric particle, the lightest superparticle, that's typically called the LSP for short, the stable. And the reason that's so interesting is that it has two observational consequences that are very important. One is that even though these models weren't designed to aim at the dark matter, they give you a dark matter candidate for free. So this property here implies that the LSP is a natural dark matter candidate. Why is that? You know, if you get supersymmetry and you ask, what would you need to describe dark matter? The story with dark matter is that you have to have an abundance of, you know, roughly the same as the other stuff around the universe now. And if you ask, you know, supposing the W boson had been stable, then what you know, which is not a bad example, Z boson was stable. So it's something which is electrically neutral. It does not participate in strong interactions, but it's kind of like particles we know exist already. It has weak interaction cross sections and a mass in the ballpark of the weak interactions. Then those things would have been in equilibrium with everything else in the early universe when it was very hot. And at some point, as the universe expands, the reaction rates get smaller, and they fall out of equilibrium. You can predict their abundance now. And the statement is that the abundance you want for dark matter is the abundance you generically get from things that have a mass of the order of the weak interactions that have cross-sections of the order of weak interaction cross-sections. And all you have to do is have it be stable, and that will automatically be something which will have the right abundance of the dark matter. And the standard model has no such candidate, not because of the first two things, because there's lots of things that have masses in the 100 GeV range. There's lots of things that have cross-sections that are weak interaction cross-sections. The thing that you don't have is anything that's in that range which is stable. And so supersymmetry is one of many classes of models which can provide you a dark matter candidate, because all they've done is they've got lots of particles, lots of new particles that are in the weak scale. Many of them are electrically neutral and don't take part in the strong interactions, like all the Higgs partners, all the leptons. And one of them is stable for free if you got rid of baryon number violation that way. And those are the three things you had to have. And so as long as you made the lightest superpartner not be electrically charged or not be colored, then you're in business. And it's going to want to have the right abundance anyway. So then it comes down to the details of getting the, how you detect these things. And so it's what's very appealing here is that you've got a framework which is not motivated by dark matter at all, and it's for free giving you a dark matter. And the second thing it implies is that there's going to be very often a signal, kind of a universal experimental signature for this kind of SUSY. So all you really need is R parity, is missing energy. That's because if you imagine that there's beams colliding and you've got a detector, so things are coming out of the detector, you know, what happens in a detector? The rule is that the heavier you are, the farther you penetrate in matter, right? And these things are just big things full of heavy elements that you're trying to lose energy from, and you're trying to see where the energy gets lost from. And so electrons go a certain distance, and muons go much farther. I mean, muons typically escape, and the only difference is electrons are lighter than muons, and the rate at which you, this is a problem I gave you actually earlier on, and I never told the answer for why, but the cross-section for energy loss is one which is goes inversely with the mass of the particle. And so the heavier you are, the lower the cross-section, so the further you penetrate. So electrons don't go as far as muons do. Particles that take part in strong interactions are typically heavier, like protons and neutrons, but they also strongly interact, so they have a cross-section that compensates a little bit, so you get things like protons and neutrons stopping too. But neutrinos, you know, they just go, and you don't even know they're there. And so in a detector, the things that you'll miss are things that have weak interactions that don't interact electromagnetically or with strong interactions, because then you don't see them. They don't make a track. And if they take part, if they only interact with the weak interactions, then their cross section is so small that they just escape before they hit anything. And so they're like neutrinos. And so things like these, if you design them to be, and it's not difficult to do, you know, half the time they're electrically neutral and not colored, then they're going to have weak interaction cross sections. They're going to be like neutrinos, except they're more massive. So they're just going to escape. And so that's a very, so as you produce, so in the reaction, if you had a fermion plus fermion bar produces a particles, superpartners to pairs, you have to pair produce, forgot to say this. If you're going to produce superpartners in a detector, you have to produce them in pairs, because that's a conserved charge, and you're starting with things that have no charge. So must pair produce superpartners. So you're going to say, get some new thing in this antiparticle. These things will decay, but whatever the decay chain is, it's going to involve stuff plus lightest supersymmetric particle eventually, because this is the lightest thing that it can decay into that has this, R parity, is this guy, and this will do the same thing. So in any decay, you always have two things. You produce these guys, you're always going to have at least two of them are going to escape, and you're not going to see them. So a very generic search criterion is missing energy, and associated with, you look for this, the stuff, you look for this stuff, that could be quarks and leptons, you see them, but they all come out the side of the detector, and then the things you don't see go out that way. So that there was there were famous events that were supposed to be examples of that in the old days when they were colliding electrons and positrons, where you could have a a massive jet would come out that way, and nothing else. And those are called Zen events because they were like the sound of one hand clapping. And so what you knew is that you're missing a whole bunch of things going on in that direction. And then they turned out in the end of the day to be so. Several times supersymmetry was discovered because of these. But what they were just neutrinos. So you have to make sure. The tricky part for the experimentalist is to say that you're seeing missing energy, but it's not just neutrinos from the standard model processes. So what else can I tell you? Oh yeah, so far we haven't broken supersymmetry. So far everybody's got exactly the same mass as everybody else. So one of the big challenges is how do you break supersymmetry? It turns out to be harder than it looks. It's supersymmetry doesn't like to break. But once you do break supersymmetry, so I won't say much about how you break supersymmetry because it's kind of a story in itself. But one of the things you might worry about is that here so what did you do? We've taken all the particles we've seen, added a new Higgs for laughs, and then duplicated them all. And then we said that we haven't seen half of them. But if somebody, imagine now that we each made up our own supersymmetric theory, and we each broke supersymmetry, and we each came back in and said, so half the particles are heavy, half of them are light. What are the odds that the ones that are light would be the ones that we've seen in the standard model as opposed to the ones we haven't seen? Is it bizarre that we should be seeing only the standard model particles and all the particles that we haven't seen are particles that are heavy? That sounds like a conspiracy as well. So once Susie breaks, why is it the, I guess sort of before I say why is it, I say when Susie breaks, the superpartners and this is spontaneously. So the action is invariant, but the ground state's not. Superpartners can get masses from their standard model counterparts. So then the question is, why is it that the standard model particles should be light? Well, the superpartners are heavy. This actually has a simple answer. It's not a conspiracy. If you kind of took 15,000 supersymmetric theories and broke supersymmetry, then what you should generically find, if the supersymmetry breaking scale is large, is of the order of or larger than the weak scale, it'll generically be true that the superpartners are heavy and the standard model particle throws the light, and there's a good reason for it. So the generic. So if the supersymmetry breaking scale is of the order of the weak scale, or higher, it is always standard model particles just like to be light. And the superpartners heavy. Why is that? That's because the Remember, none of the standard model particles got a mass until we broke SE2 for SE1 to break. That was the problem with the standard model. We couldn't, it was hard to give everybody mass. So all standard model particles only get masses once SE2 cross U1 breaks. And so they're necessarily of order B because they're, so their masses are of the order of some Yukawa coupling times V. And so if this is a perturbative Yukawa coupling, then this is less of the order of B. And the problem in the standard model was, why is the electron so very light? A top quark and a W boson, they were kind of a generic mass size for generic coupling times V. The light ones are hard to understand because we have to say that the Yukawa couplings are really, really small for some reason. Well, how does that story work for the superpartners? You know, so once you break supersymmetry, then they're allowed to get a mass, but maybe they also transform under SE2 cross U1. Maybe they're also forbidden from getting a mass. And if that were true, you'd expect them to all be down with the standard model particles. But the superpartners are these guys, or these guys, or these guys. And so the question is, you know, can we forbid them from getting masses? These guys are scalars. And remember, the hierarchy problem was all about the fact that it's impossible to stop a scalar from getting a big mass. And the problem was, for the hierarchy problem, what stops the Higgs scalar from getting a big mass? So for the scalars, these are the Schwarz and the Sleptons. SE2 cross U1 cannot forbid a mass term being phi star of phi, because that's invariant, phi dagger phi, take the SE2 cross U1 indices, times some big mass scale squared. So they would generically like to get, this will have to be at most the supersymmetry scale, because if supersymmetry is not broken, then they have to be the same as the standard model particles. But the upshot is that this thing, if the Susie breaking scale is large compared to B, then this will be of the order of the Susie breaking scale, possibly times some dimensional coupling. So it's something you'd expect to be fairly big. Now, what about the fermions? The fermions that are superpartners all have the property that they are well, these guys, they're all in the adjoint representation of a group because they have to transform the way the gauge bosons do. And the adjoint representation is a real representation. There's no gauge invariance does not forbid you from writing down something lambda bar lambda, because that has the same symmetry properties as F mu nu. So the fact that you can write down a gauge invariant kinetic term also allows you to write down a gauge invariant mass term. So for the gauginos, are in the adjoint representation. And so, which is a real representation, that's the important thing. So are also not forbidden mass. You write down lambda bar alpha, lambda alpha. And the Higgsinos, you know, if you had only one of them, you could have forbidden the mass because it's like a lepton, but you've got both of them and they both have opposite hypercharge. This is the real representation, so nothing SE2 doesn't stop you from writing down a gauge invariant mass. And hypercharge used to stop you for the leptons, but it can't anymore because you've got one of each. So you can write down an H. That's what allowed us to write this term, basically, which is a mass term. And so the Higgsinos you can get a psi up type for gamma left, psi down type. For the Higgsinos. So generically, when you break supersymmetry, all the things we have not seen are allowed to get, are automatically, you know, their transformation properties under the standard model gauge group were dictated by the symmetries. And they are exactly the ones that you'd expect to get a mass because they're not protected by the SE2 cross U1 invariants. And if they're no longer protected by supersymmetry, then they'll get as big a mass as they can. Whereas the ones that we do see, the standard model particles, we understand why they're light compared to heavier scales, because that's the modern understanding as to why it was so hard to get mass in the standard model, that's why you see those particles. If you had a theory, if the world has got lots of scales, but most of them are big compared to the ones we can access, you generically you think, well, why do we see anything? Why isn't everything up at the highest mass scale that we can't produce? The only reason that we see particles at all is that the particles we do see can't get a mass at all until you break the symmetry, and it happens that the symmetry breaking scale isn't very high. And so we actually understand that the real question is not why something is heavy, it's why anything is light at all. And we have a good understanding of that in the standard model. And so in particular, when you break supersymmetry, it's, what's nice is that all the superpartners don't have that same understanding, so you'd expect them to generically be heavy. And so the picture that things can be as heavy as they will be as heavy as they can is consistent with what you see in the supersymmetric spectrum and what you don't see. So half the supersymmetric spectrum has been found already. That's the standard model. And we're just waiting for the other half. I guess the last thing the book talks about is the Higgs sector. The Higgs sector is a little bit interesting because of the fact that you've got two Higgs now. The Higgs sector, so one of the reasons the Higgs sector is interesting is that although this is generically true, the Higgs sector is the one place where it's true that this was the partners. For the things that we said were the standard model partners, we've included two Higgses, which we didn't have before. So the next question should we expect to be seeing these two Higgses? Because that argument doesn't apply to them. So, what about the other? Because we didn't really just have the standard model, we had the standard model plus another Higgs duplicated. Well, generically, so what do we have? We have the Kalle couplings have the form of, if you had two Higgs, what could you have had? You could have had something like quark, bar, gamma left, up, times, h up. So here I'm ignoring supersymmetry. If I just made a two Higgs doublet model, what would I? I want to contrast what you generically get with two Higgs doublet models and what you get from supersymmetric two Higgs doublet models. So you have things like this. We had q bar, gamma left, b, b, plus q bar, l bar. But then we could have also had, q bar, gamma left u, hd, twiddle. Q bar, gamma left b, hd, twiddle. Well, these are the complex conjugate fields, right? Because these things transform the same way that these things do. Now, what you generically find is that if you have both this term and this term, then we need to give a vector. So the up type quark, so what do we have? We have a up. So the things were. The thing that's the 5 plus 5 zero is what we normally call the Higgs, right? And that's a thing which has hypercharge plus a half, because that's what makes this thing electrically neutral. And that's the thing which I was calling H up before, right? Because an uptype quark is going to pair off with that guy and get a vet.
That's right.
So the downtype quarks, in terms of electric charge, there's a neutral guy, let's call it phi. Not curly phi, but phi naught, phi minus. It has the same quantum numbers as the lepton double does, so the neutral guy is a pop, the neutrino. When it gets one of the things you have to check is that the potential is minimized by, when you look in the vacuum, we want this guy to have a VEV, say U, or let's say V sub U. And this guy, I get a VEV V sub D and zero, because we don't want to break electromagnetic invariance. So you have to check that V is minimized by this. And you want to also check that the sporks are all zero in the vacuum when you minimize them. And that the leptons don't get an excitation value because you break the lepton membrane. So there are choices for the potential which do that once you break supersymmetry. And it's interesting that these kind of things are favored by heavy top quarks, because the stop quark, the scalar one, couples the strongest everybody. And if you look at the renormalization or how these things run, the various coupling constants, the mass term for these guys goes negative because of the contribution of stop quarks, it turns out. So that there's a natural, the fact that the top quark is heavy fits well with the fact that these things have a minimum that does this. That's an aside. Bottom line is, when you look at the masses here, you're going to get the uptight masses. If you have both these terms, this one and this one, you're going to get a contribution to the masses, which is a linear combination of these things. And what do we do when we get the masses? We do the thing you said. We're going to try and diagonalize the mass terms, and we're going to see how things look in terms of the mass eigenfaces. And when we do that, we have to check. So once masses are diagonalized, the question is, are the Z fermion bar fermion vertices, are they still flavor diagonal? And the answer is, they're not. If you have both this, if these coefficients are aij and this is bij, generically, if you have both of them, you find that the rotations you do are such that these neutral currents are no longer diagonal. And that's bad news experimentally, that there's a real problem there. So people who look at models of more than one Higgs knew that if you write down all the interactions that are consistent, you generically have a problem with two rapid processes like k goes to mu plus mu minus, happening because there's an s bar d here which goes to mu plus mu minus. That's going to a z boson which goes to mu plus mu minus. That kind of an off-diagonal flavor thing is the thing that, so that's the process where the z exchange happened, and this is the kaon. That's never seen, and the rate for it would be way too large if you just calculate that graph using the weak interaction cross section. So the absence of that kind of thing is shows you that this is a real problem. And so what's nice about supersymmetry is it didn't give you any of these guys. And so it doesn't have that problem at face value, because the things that couple to the up quarks, only one Higgs coupled to the up quarks, and the other Higgs coupled to the down quarks, and no one Higgs coupled to them both. And that's the thing that gives you a problem with these kind of off diagonal. So that's a good thing. There's another good thing. What was the other good thing? So now the masses of the uptight quarks are going to be of the order of these coupling constants. Let's call this one y up times this up bev. And the masses of the downtight quarks are going to be something like y down times the downtight bev. And the leptons will be of the order of y lepton times the downtight bev. But now the ratio of the uptight to the downtight masses doesn't have to be just due to the fact of that. So if I ask what's the ratio of the electron to the top quark, in the standard model, the smallness of this ratio was all to do with the smallness of the atomic coupling of the electron, because the bevs of the Higgs canceled here. But if you have more than one Higgs here now, this would be actually the proportion of the electron, the atomic coupling divided by the top atomic coupling, but also the downtype bev divided by the uptype bev. And so depending on how big the relative size of these valves is, you could understand why it's the top quarks that are very heavy compared to everybody else. Because it might be that valve is very heavy compared to that valve. So the burden of the small masses is no longer necessarily all stuck in the smallness of the valves, smallness of the atomic couplings. It may also be that this ratio of V down over V up, which is typically called pan beta, is a could be small. It'd be up over D, and only if V up or V down is the thing they call that. It could be large. So that's also attractive, that you might not have to put so much burden on having teeny electron Yukawa couplings, because you all of the W boson and Z boson mass sees is V up squared plus V down squared. That has to be 246 GeV squared. But the ratio is not constrained by the size of the W masses and the Z mass. So many features there are attractive. What's also attractive is that the when you break supersymmetry, the things you tend to change in the potential are the things that are cubic or quadratic, but not the things that are quartic. And the masses of these scalars are sensitive to the quartic part of the potential, because in a Higgs potential, what's happening is you in a Higgs potential, the potential is doing something like this. And the curvature you get here is a balancing between the phi to the fourth term and the phi squared term. And so it turns out for the Higgs particles that the quartic terms, there's a piece of the scalar potential I haven't told you about, actually. So I haven't told you about the gauge interaction. There's a scalar. So just be aware that I haven't told you the whole story of the potential. Quartic terms turn out to be proportional to the gauge couplings. With things like G1 squared, G2 squared. So you get things like Higgs, Dagger. Well, things that are quartic in the fields with these gauge couplings. And so the thing is that because the quartic terms in the potential are not corrected by the supersymmetry breaking things, supersymmetry is what's making these things related to the gauge couplings. Because there's not supersymmetry breaking, it tends not to give you a quartic term of the potential. The kind of masses you get for the Higgs tend to be related to the masses you get for the W and Z boson, because the couplings involved on this side of it are related. And so there's a generic statement that you typically expect. So you expect one Higgs to be, less than around the order of, classically, it would have to be lighter than the Z boson, but once you put in quantum corrections, it's lighter than about, say 130 or so GeV. So one thing you expect in these things is that there's some of the Higgs is alike. And I say Higgs is because if you ask how many Higgs did you have, we had phi plus phi naught, and we had phi naught minus. Now altogether we've got four complex fields, so that's eight real fields. But the W and the Z bosons are going to eat three of them, right? Because that's the longitudinal mode of the W and Z takes three, so we have minus three Goldstone. Three longitudinal modes for W and Z. That means that there's a total of five scalars that are left. W was charged and the Z was neutral, so we had two charged scalars and four neutral ones. So with this five, one of the charged ones was eaten by the W, so we're expecting that to be one charged. So that's two real scalars and then three neutral. So there's a richer Higgs sector, one of which is expected to be light. So if I can get through random unification, we're done. There's other things in this chapter that I'm not talking about, like the axions, the strong CP problem, but I think that's why you bought the book. So the warm-up is, there's one piece of evidence, and it's kind of circumstantial, let's say, circumstantial evidence. Susie. And that is that if you I told you that the coupling constants run. So alpha 3, alpha 2, and alpha 1, the three gauge couplings, all with energy. And in particular, you know, 1 over alpha I at some energy was equal to 1 over alpha I at, say, the z scale, or some scale that you know it, plus some coefficient times the logarithm of you know, the energy divided by the z mass, let's say. So if you plot, you know, 1 over alpha against energy, the log of energy, then they're straight lines, and the two non-abelian couplings get smaller with larger energies. So that means 1 over them gets bigger. So the strong interactions do something like that. This is SU3. SU2 doesn't climb quite so fast. So it's not a parallel line. And then the SU2 coupling comes down. And an interesting question is whether they cross. And with the standard model, they don't quite cross. You know what they are at the Z mass, so you kind of know where you're starting off here. And there's a bigger error in SU3 coupling, so that there's a certain amount of uncertainty in that one. But within the uncertainty, the E1 cross does not, they don't cross here. It was only in the last 10 years or 15 years that people have actually had the errors sufficiently small that you could tell they didn't cross. And before that, people were hopeful that they would cross. But they don't cross. But that assumes that when you're calculating these coefficients, that you're doing that with the standard model particle only. And you remember, what went into that was we were calculating graphs like this, where we had gauge fields and then we had things in the loop. So the more things you have in the loop, the more different these things become. So this statement depends on the particles you have. Now, the interesting thing is that if you had super partners, then that calculation would change. Because if you gave a whole bunch of partners to the known particles' masses of the order of the weak scale, the place where the crossing happens is actually quite high. You know, this is logarithmic scale. So if this is like 100 GeV, this is at, you know, 10 to the 15 GeV. So it's way up there, 10 to the 14 or 15. But if you change these coefficients, if the BIs are computed using the supersymmetric spectrum, so we're saying that all the superpartners are here because they have masses of the order of 1,000 GeV or something. We're supposed to really calculate the slopes of these lines using the standard model particles plus all the supersymmetric ones. Then what happens is that things change when you cross where the partners are. So here's the Z mass. Here's where the superpartners are, let's say. So it's not very far. Now here is. So they start off climbing. There's a small change. Actually, I can't remember which way it goes. I think it makes it more steep. I'm not sure about that. And then the same thing, this is SU3 again. SU2 did something like that too. U1 to something else like that too. And now they cross within the errors. Again, at energies of the order of, you know, 10 to the 14 or 15 GeV. So that's kind of tantalizing. That's called coupling unification. And that is the one piece of evidence that things would be nice. So there's an observational statement here that the couplings that you had down here, when you ran them up, they knew each other. That didn't have to happen. And it didn't happen with the standard model.
What if you were to just add a whole bunch of extra particles at that mass, if that works?
You could screw it up, yeah.
You could just remove, like,
depending on what you added.
What's that?
Depending on what you add. Okay. So if you add, the thing is that, let me come back in a sec, why would they match up? One way, so this is taken as a sign. This could be evidence for grand unification. Of the interactions. And that's based on Grandification is based on the discomfort that, you know, why take a gauge group which is SU3 cross SU2 cross U1? We're allowed to have free coupling because these things all commuted with each other. What if we just took a gauge group which had no factors that was commuted at all, and we don't have one coupling? Why not something like SU5 or SU10, just to take two random examples? Then, if you can stick this inside of this, you could hope that spontaneous symmetry breaking would break this group down to this group at some high energy scale, in the same way that SU2 plus U1 gets broken down to electromagnetism at a low energy scale. And if that happened, it would have to be true that the couplings all agreed at that point, because at that point, the theory actually has a bigger gauge symmetry which only has one coupling. And so then you'd have a reason why they were to meet. So now to your question, if you added, so what you're going to find is that the standard model particles actually fall into multiples of SU5. That's an amazing fact. If you add SU5 multiplets, you don't change this fact that they meet, because the SU5 multiplets are, the thing that makes them diverge is the fact that these things are not, all the elements of an SU5 multiplet have not been kept. So for instance, for the gauge bosons, there's many more gauge bosons here than there were here. And so the contribution of the gauge bosons to the running of the coupling down here, it doesn't see the extra ones. As long as you're at energies where you include all the SU5 particles, these couplings have to run the same way, because that's the same for the SU5, the couplings, if there's only one coupling. So you only get them splitting down here because you've taken the particle multiplets in SU5 and you've made some heavy and some light. So all the fermions are light, so they don't do anything interesting. But the Higgs is, for instance, the Higgs that we see that's light fits into an SU5 multiplet with some other Higgs which we haven't seen, which would be very heavy. And so the statement is that if the new particles you added were in one of these groups, then their contributions, they change these Bs, but they don't change the difference of Bs, so that they don't change the fact that they meet. They change maybe where they meet, but they don't change the fact that they do meet. But if you just start adding random fields, then you're going to start changing, you can make them not meet. So the interesting thing is that if you added the supersymmetric partners of the standard model, that does make them meet, changing it from the standard model. But it's far from unique. There's lots of things you could do that would also make them meet. You know, two lines had to meet. The third line, you had one thing worth it, and that's the constraint. So for SU5, imagine that what we're going to do is that the gauge couplings, they're all the generators are 5x5 matrices. So let's imagine them to be, here's 3 and here's 2. So we're going to imagine that this is the SU3 color, this is the SU2, and the U1 has to commute with these things. So it'll be the U1 generator will be the thing that's a unit matrix here and a unit matrix here, but the values in front of this matrix are not the same. So that's why it's not the unit matrix completely. For the generator, any SU matrix has to satisfy the trace of the generator is a 0. So the U1 we're going to make to be, it'll be, say, 2 times the unit matrix. And here we'll have minus 3 times the unit matrix. So this is a 3x3 unit matrix. This is a 2x2 one. So this commutes with this, commutes with this. These commute with each other. And so there's an SU3 cross SU2 cross U1 subgroup of SU5. Now, the interesting thing is that you can take the fermions in SU5 of the standard model, and you can just stick them in SU5 representations with nothing else needed to add. Let me just. So the down type and electronic. So the down type and the leptons, the right-handed parts of those, they transform as a 5 of SU5. 5 or 5 bar? 5, I think. 5 bar. So this thing gets multiplied by 5x5 unitary transformations. It's a naive way. And then there's an anti-symmetric representation, which has got as a 10. And that's got the... So it's an anti-symmetric 5x5 matrix, and it contains the standard model fields in the following way. So it's got the epsilon, alpha, beta, gamma, u gamma, minus q, alpha, I, J, sorry. Q I beta and epsilon I J P. So the matter content for the fermions with nothing extra added gives you representations of SU5. Where the what you're asking for is you're asking that restricted to this subgroup, you get the standard model charge assignments. That's what you're asking. But now you have all these guys over here are new gauge bosons which mediate transitions, say, between leptons and quarks. And so there's a whole bunch of interactions that happen which have to violate the baryon number because the leptons and the quarks are appearing together. So the other interesting piece of phenomenon of numerology is so SU5 interactions must break baryon number and leptons number. We'll be done in about 5 minutes. And so that means that implies that there's going to be processes like where you exchange one of these new particles. And you can do things like you can have a lepton here, quark here, quark here. And in that process, you can have something like a proton decay to a quantum and electron, say. You can have decays like that. Where the three quarks here, two of them paired off, became decayed into the lepton. And then the remaining one, it's a bit long, actually. So two of the quarks turned into another quark and a lepton. And then the speculative quark went along and made a pion of the quark that was left over. Now, the rate for this decay, this is going to go like we've seen, it's like weak interactions. The amplitude for this decay is going to go like 1 over, it's going to go like a coupling constant squared divided by the mass of this thing squared. And so the rate for this decay is going to go like g to the fourth divided by the mass to the fourth. And on dimensional grounds, we're missing mass. This thing has to have dimensions of mass. The thing that's decaying, the energy in the final state is set by the proton. We'll get the proton mass to the fifth power there. And if you ask, how big does m have to be to make this an acceptable decay? The proton lifetime is known to be many times longer than the age of the universe. And the fact that the lifetime of the proton is bigger than the experimental bound basically says that this x has to be less than or the order of 10 to the 15 and 16 GeV. So the interesting coincidence is that that scale is pretty much this scale. This is happening at 10 to the 14, 15 GeV. So when the factor is a dimensionless factor, it's the scale at which you could have baryon number violation and just be detecting it now is consistent with the scale where something interesting could be happening with the coupling. So that's kind of the tantalizing numerology. So that's a good place to break. So I would propose that we stop here because there's nothing to say next time. So unless you guys complain, then I'll tell Debbie that she'll need to line up the transportation for you guys and for you guys next time. Unless you want to physically come in and hand in the assignments, so the only thing that's left is the assignment we'll be doing in 2 weeks. And the simplest thing to do would be to you guys do it with Alex. I don't know if Alex is coming in and then he's got a baby. One or another. So he wants to get some sleep, right? So he comes in. So I'll ask Alex if we can set something up from there, and I can get the ones from right after, and the people that are here just leave it here, and then I can pick it up right here. That's probably the simplest.
So it's due 2 weeks?
2 weeks, yeah, middle of April is what we said, right? Yeah. We're leaving now, so come on in.